All right, let's start. So tonight we're going to continue our research into the history of Tanakh. And we're going to talk about a difficult subject, which is biblical criticism. I don't know whether we'll talk about all the things that I wanted to talk about or just talk about some of them. It's not something that I'm an expert in. The truth is I have not done that much research in my life. For the last couple of weeks, I've been researching it pretty heavily because it's caught my interest. But it's something that, let me put it this way. There's a man named James Kugel who wrote a book, an American professor. He was an Orthodox Jew, but he wrote a book about biblical criticism. I think it's called Who Wrote the Bible? I don't remember exactly what it's called. And he investigates all the theories about who wrote the Bible and the modern theories that it was written by humans. And he's an Orthodox Jew. And one time he was giving a lecture, and after the lecture, a high school teacher came up to him and said, "You know, you should know, I use your book to teach my high school students, a modern Orthodox high school." And Professor Kugel was aghast. He said, "What do you mean? You teach high school students biblical criticism? They're not ready for that. You're going to just confuse them." And the teacher said, "If you think they don't already know about this, you're kidding yourself." In other words, even kids in high school in America, I don't know about in Israel, but probably in Israel as well, definitely if they don't go to Mamlachti Dati schools, if they go to regular schools, I assume that this is what they at least teach it as an option, if not the truth, because in college, this is basically taught as the truth. If you go to any secular college, this is how Bible is taught. So what is biblical criticism? So in general, textual criticism is the study of a text. There used to be a distinction between what's called higher criticism and lower criticism. Higher criticism being the question of when a text was written and by whom, and lower criticism, an actual study of the text, like the words of the text and trying to understand it and meaning of it and the patterns. That kind of distinction has kind of fallen away in the past recently. So we just talk about higher criticism, which is the study of any text really, when it was written and by whom and why. And what was the agenda of the authors? So transferring that to the Bible, the question becomes for people, who wrote the Bible, but and why did they write it, and when did they write it? These are the kinds of questions that started coming up in the 17th century. Spinoza and his friends, they believed that it was written by humans and not written by God, and certainly not by Moses, or at least not all of it. And the theory started to float around. People, it didn't really take hold until a man named Julius Wellhausen basically presented a very popular theory, which became known as the documentary hypothesis, which basically posits that the Torah is all of Tanakh, but let's focus on the Torah because that's what we care more about, is comprised of basically copy and paste from different, we call them manuscripts or texts or traditions, which were put together by one person. Each kind of manuscript was written in a different time period by different kinds of people, and they were put together by a redactor, by the person who puts together all the traditions. Lahavdil, the way that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi did to the Mishnah, somebody did that to the Tanakh.
To believe that, would that mean I have to disbelieve in the divine origins of the Torah?
So, I mean, not necessarily in the divine origins of the Torah, but definitely it goes against the traditional way of understanding what the Torah is.
Are you making a distinction between Torah Shebichtav and Bo Peh?
I'm only talking about Torah Shebichtav. For all intents and purposes, from Wellhausen's perspective, there is no such thing. I mean, there's such a thing as Torah Shebaal Peh, but it's based on a false premise, which is that God wrote the entire, or God dictated to Moshe the entire Torah. If you don't believe that, then all of Torah Shebaal Peh, as we'll talk about, if you could put Torah Shebaal Peh in a box for a minute, then things start to make sense. If you don't, all the drashot that the rabbis come up with, which are basically answers to the questions that biblical criticism raises, that's basically what Torah Shebaal Peh is. If you don't believe that, the simpler answer from the biblical critic's perspective is, no, it's just people made mistakes, and that's why you have all of these weird things in Tanakh. Torah Shebaal Peh is the answer if you don't believe that. But let's put Torah Shebaal Peh on the side for a second. So what did Wellhausen propound? So he believed, this has been modified recently, but the most popular version of Wellhausen's theory, I have it over here if you open up the file. So he believed that there were basically four major authors, or the original authors of the Bible, as we know it, J, E, P, and D. Those are the nicknames we give them. And each one is responsible for different parts of the Torah, and they all get combined by someone else who we call R, which is the redactor. Okay, so what is each one? So each one, they have J, which is the Yahwist, which is basically Yudke Vavke. Anytime the Yudke Vavke shows up, J-H-V-H, that's why it's called J. So that's attributed to him, right? So it gets his name because it uses and allows humans to use the name even before Israel exists. J appears, and they even give dates. Now, of all the things, the thing that is least clear, even according to the biblical theorists, is what these dates are. Nobody agrees on any of the dates. They agree roughly that J was probably composed during the times of the Malachim, and you'll see why in a minute. Then you have E, who is the Elohist, meaning any time the word, the name of God of Elohim shows up, that's written by E, and it's usually, they say that it was written later, and the distinction between J and E appears to be, according to these critics, that J is written by Malachim who are from Yehuda, basically Malchei Yehuda, and E is by Malchei Yisrael. So that's kind of like this rivalry that they'll say that anytime you have a J pasuk, so it kind of bolsters the Judaic monarchy. We know that during the times of the Nevi'im, after the times of Shlomo HaMelech, basically, the kingdom split into two, right? We know that the kingdom split into two, into the north and the south, into Yehuda and Israel. So they want to attribute that to J and E. Then you have P, which is the priestly source. So that's anything that has to do with Kohanim, most of the things that have to do with the Mishkan, Vayikra, that is all by P. Okay, which is just a whole other book. And then you have D, which is basically Dvarim. It's they want to say that it's actually made up of two different sections. So it's not even one D. And that's basically the story. And then you have R, whose job it was to put everything together. David. Now, what's the reason for this? Why do they do this? So the answer is that biblical criticism comes along to answer a certain set of questions. What set of questions? Now, I said to put Torah Shabbat Peh on the side because Torah Shabbat Peh answers all the questions that they want to ask. But they ask the questions that they want to ask are basically, you know, one major one is contradictions. Let's say you have a contradiction in Tanakh, in Torah, in Chumash. So if you didn't have Torah Shabbat Peh and you saw a contradiction, right? So I'll give you an example of a contradiction, right? So we have a little bit later down in the file, I have a few examples, not so many.
Isn't the whole fundamental terms of the discussion flawed in even trying to separate out between Torah Shabbat Peh and Torah Shabbat Peh? Because for us, one of our fundamental tenets is you don't have one without the other. So anyone who's trying to raise any issues, they're only... They're breaking half of the story.
Absolutely. Well,
doesn't that negate any...
So most of the questions that biblical criticism brings up, Chazal already dealt with. There are some that you could say that they didn't, that were dealt with by the Rishonim. But the point is that for the biblical critic, he thinks he's got a much simpler answer to all of the questions, which is that the people who put this together were flawed. They were human, and they were just trying to put together different tribal traditions. And that's why you have, for example, I'll give you an example. In Vayikra it says, Usfartam lachami macharat ha-shabbat, miyom ha-viyachem et omer ha-tmufa, sheva shabbatot mimot tihiyana. Right? So that's what it says in Vayikra. So how many days is that? What? Right. How many days is that, if it's sheva shabbatot mimot?
49.
It's 49. The very next pasuk, ad mimachat ha-shabbat, shvi'it, tisperu, chamishim yom. 50 days. What happened there?
And the guy putting together just didn't realize.
Oh, so good. Excellent. So Yoel is already giving one of the responses to the biblical criticism, which I guess we can do this out of order. Rabbi Carmi, who taught me Bible, so one of the points that he made is that this is amazing theory that basically this stuff, all the things that the biblical critics discuss, went undetected until the 17th century. Despite the fact that it was being studied for, everybody agrees, at least 2,000 years, no matter when you date it, it was being studied, it existed for 2,500 years or so, right, by the time you got to the 17th century. But nobody actually figured this out until the biblical critics.
Be saying, on the 50th day.
We have answers, right? They have questions. We have answers, but they don't like our answers because they say that they have a simpler answer. The simpler answer is that people made mistakes. One of the points is that, which Joel makes, which is, right, Carmi says basically, the redactor was so good at his job that nobody figured it out for 2,500 years, but so bad at his job that when we start looking at it, it's obvious to us. Yeah. So that's kind of difficult. But okay, fine, let's put that on the side. But there is another class of question, which we brought up last time, I think, which is another issue. Forget about contradictions. This is a hard question to deal with. It says in Bereishis, Ve'ela malachim asher malchu ba'aretz adom lifnei melech meloch melech livnei Yisrael. Right, we brought this up last time. Psukim in the Chumash, which seem to clearly refer to times which come way after the Chumash would have been written, according to us. Right? How could Moshe have written a pasuk like before the times of the reign of the kings of Israel? There were no kings of Israel during the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. So how could he write such a pasuk? Right? Unless you posit that it was written by somebody later and it was interpolated in afterwards. Now, you could still take the position that everything else was written by Moshe and then somehow this pasuk kind of crept in later. You could take that position. There are people who have taken that position in the past. It's not something that we're very comfortable with. Or you could take a different position and to say that this is written in as a prophecy. None other than Ibn Ezra takes this position. Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra, a Pashtan, who had no interest actually in bringing in Chazal so much when he was explaining the Pshat and the Chumash in the stories, he said this whole thing is written in as prophecy. In other words, in Achinami, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote this about the future. So it didn't happen yet. You get into the thorny issues that we talked about a couple weeks ago about Moshe Rabbeinu writing about things that didn't happen yet, whether it's true or not true. But that's what the Ibn Ezra suggests. Another issue, for example, the reason why you have this J and E, right? Because you'll notice that very, very often in the Chumash, you have stories that are repeated. And sometimes when they're repeated with certain differences that are consistently different. Now, what am I referring to? The most famous example of this? Aseret HaDibur is a good example of that. But even in the text, you can give an example, you can give an explanation, because there Moshe Rabbeinu is writing it down. But let's say, what about the first two chapters? Actually, the second and the third chapter of Bereishit. Right? We know, you just look it up, basically throughout the second chapter of Bereishit and the creation of man, what name of God is used? Elohim, 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 Elohim. Almost exclusively, I think exclusively. And then in the third chapter, when the story is kind of fleshed out, what name is used? Yudke Vavke. So the Wellhausen comes along and says, yeah, that's because, and by the way, the stories are radically different from each other, right? In one, man is created with woman. The other man is created, and then woman is created afterwards. In one, there are animals beforehand, and in the other, there are animals after man is created. They're brought into Gan Eden. So there's a lot of differences, a lot of things to deal with over there. The stories are not the same at all. They're two different stories in the second and the third chapter. So Wellhausen will say, yeah, because one is written by J and one is written by E. There were two separate traditions. Paste them together. They're the same story, so they put them in the same spot in the Chumash. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a book about this called Lonely Man of Faith, and he explained that, no, it's the same story but told from two different perspectives. Actually, I want to hold off before we get there.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
To accept that there were two different people and they paste it together would mean that this redactor was a very poor editor.
He was both good and bad.
I believe that this, well, it was so obvious that this redactor was terrible that I would never hire him to edit. I wouldn't let him edit the Daily News.
Unless he wasn't interested in fooling anybody. Unless this was obvious.
Yeah, that's what I said. But for 2,000 years, like, you have people fooled.
Well, or see, look, do we have any precedent for anything like this, where you have different traditions that are pasted together? So the answer is not much, but there is one, and it's kind of important, which is the Gospels. The Christian Gospels, they had a bunch of different stories, and they pasted them together into kind of one coherent story. The difference is there that everybody knew that.
That's 1,000 years later.
And also, everybody knew that it was happening.
Well,
nobody.
In 1,000 years' time, they won't think it. If maybe in 1,000 years' time, they'll also think that it was written by one person.
There would be a trace of it, right? There would be some trace of it. Here's the big difference. I was going to bring this up later. One of the things that the biblical critics would have loved to have found, let's say, for example, in the Qumran caves or in the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? What would they have loved to have found? J, E, P, Or D.
And these are from that time period.
In other words, they would have found, it would have been nice if they could actually found distinct traditions that would have been written down. Like, if we're saying that J was pasted together with E, so let's find J or E. But you never found anything like that. You don't find any version of the Bible that is actually split in the any even close to the way that these things are split. Now, I'm being a little bit disingenuous because over time, modern scholarship has evolved and kind of gone away from the very strict J, P, E, and D. They keep these things kind of intact in order to refer to them, but things have gotten a little bit more complicated with the same broad theories being bandied about, but a little bit more complicated than just saying, oh, there's just this, 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 and this.
What's the oldest complete Torah scroll that we have here?
Well, an actual scroll, as in like the oldest version of we have, that full version of Tanakh that is reliable, is what we talked about, the Keter, which is about a little bit less than 1,000 years old. But we have stuff from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is much older.
As in the Christian Old Testament, which is the same as ours, pretty much.
The Septuagint, yeah, we have that stuff.
So like that's yeah, more and than 1,000 years old.
Yeah, well, I mean, these theories say that they were written in, you know, this said that 800 BCE. So
it must have been finished. The compilation must have been finished. Well,
they want to say that J and E were written during the time of Malachim.
850,
right, and obviously P would have been written probably during the first Beit HaMikdash as well.
So by Sheni, this would have been.
No, by Rishon. Yeah, by Rishon.
No, because he talks about something.
800 BCE is by Rishon.
Yeah, many scholars say that
6th century,
which is still, which is Golos, which is between Bais Rishon and Bais Sheni.
Is that clear? Okay. P, you mean? Okay, maybe. Yeah.
Does Rashi or they deal with a different style?
Names of Hashem, things like that. Oh, different styles. Oh,
different styles. Because it's not really a pshat.
Which?
For Rashi to address it, for example.
What do you mean by different style?
Well, you're referring to, you know, different styles in Bereishis, in Noach.
So, definitely with the names of Hashem. We have a bunch of traditions about that.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the names of Hashem. I'm talking about in terms of animals, Armachava.
Right. So if you look at Rashi on that, Rashi explicitly says there are not two stories. This is one story, which Rabbi Soloveitchik ignores in his book. So that's one. Yeah. So Rashi will have to do work in order to figure out how exactly everything works out. If there were two different stories, or if there are two different versions of the same story but told wildly differently, we'd have to figure out why that is. And that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote his book about, and we're going to see Rabbi Mordechai Breuer addresses this as well. I want to go on. There's a lot to say about the arguments. How do we deal with these arguments? So there are at least four distinct schools of thought about, let's say three distinct schools of thought about how we should, as Orthodox Jews, deal with these kinds of issues. I actually have a quote here. It's all the way at the bottom, I think. No, actually, it's not. It's Rabbi, you know, we'll start with him. We'll start before that. Rabbi Tzvi Tao, who is one of the leading lights in the religious Zionist movement right now, right from Har Bracha. So he's from the rejectionist school. He basically just says, we should ignore it. All this stuff. Anybody who doesn't have Torah Shebaal Peh, anybody who doesn't know, you know, the very basics of the way that we look at the Chumash, can't have anything of value at all to say about Tanakh and about Chumash. It's not even worth looking at. It's not worth talking about. We shouldn't have their Sfarim. We shouldn't listen to them. They have nothing to add to the conversation. And you can go that way.
So, I think you'll start the conversation with this one.
What?
Starting the conversation with him. So according to him, what happens from this point forward in this series of Shurim is a waste of time.
Yeah, well, he says it's not even worth talking about. It's not worth talking about. Obviously, the chisaron there is that, you know, kids don't listen to that. And we have to work in environments with people who aren't as traditional, as firm as we are, and questions come up, and those questions will come up towards us. You know, if, for example, if somebody brings up to us, it happened to me at work, where somebody brings up to me that, you know, Noach, the story of Noach, is basically a redo of something called the Gilgamesh epic, which predates Noach. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that? How do you answer that? Now, the truth is, it's actually good news. It's actually better news than almost anything else. Not only does it back it up, Professor Josh Berman uses a version of this somewhere else. The Az Yashir song, right? That we have, you find in the Torah. I'm going way out of order here, by the way, just going stream of consciousness because we're discussing. Exactly. In Muktam Uchar, I'm more of a Ramban kind of guy, but fine. Josh Berman points out that the Az Yashir song, right, is a modern scholars want to say that it was basically the style of it was a very late, I forget which century, a very late, it was written in the same style as a war song from a very late time. He pointed out, actually, no, it's almost exactly like the Egyptian victory songs from the time of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Now, if I were to say to you out of context, if I were to say that the Az Yashir song is basically almost in exact same style as the Egyptian victory songs from the time of Yitziat Mitzrayim, would you say that that's a firm statement or a non-firm statement? If I would, just out of context. It's a
brilliant statement. Great statement.
You think it's a great statement?
It means you have empirically proven from other sources that this is a genuine.
So, that's how he goes with it. I would have said if I were to go into a room and say, you know, Az Yashir is basically a copy of Egyptian victory songs, I think people will get upset.
It's not very godly.
Right, people will get upset. But the truth is that the worst you can say from that statement is that Moses ripped off an Egyptian song. And I would take that any day, because basically what it means is that according to biblical criticism, right, the whole section is written 1,000 years later. Now, without Google...
This gives it a historical placement.
Exactly. Without Google, without an archive, how in the world would anybody in 800 BCE be able to recreate an Egyptian victory song? How would they know what it sounded, what it would be written like? We know because we have all of this research and archaeology that would investigate it.
Very easy to answer that as well. I mean, they can say it as in like, even like the Jedi, whatever, GDP. As in like, it's quite possible. As in like, they themselves would put together traditions that they had over the previous 2,000 years. And
you're saying that the story, something happened.
Yeah, as in, GED wasn't necessarily written at that, in that, it was a one-year period. It was compiled.
But it would mean that the story itself must date, it must have happened. The story itself must have happened, and it was written down at the time, because you can't write in that style a 1,000 years later.
But what's the whole rationale here? Is it that they're critiquing the essence of the Torah or different elements of it and saying, because this part doesn't fit with that, therefore the fundamental tenet of it all being from Hashem isn't...
They're saying like this, one author, if it was only one author, then you would expect that there wouldn't be contradictions between different sections in the Torah. Now, we grew up knowing that there were contradictions between sections in the Torah, and that's what Torah Shabbat Peh is for, and that's what Shas is for. That's what Shas, that's its bread and butter. But if you didn't take that as a given, and you just looked at the Chumash, and you said, "No, this is strange." In one part of the flood story, it says that it was for 40 days, and in, it was raining for 40 days, and in another, it says that there was water for 150 days. Huh? That's weird. Looks like somebody messed up the story. Now, we just look at Rashi, and we say, okay, so he explains that it rained for 40 days, but the water stayed for 150 days. All these pshatim. But if you didn't have Rashi, and all you had was the text, you would say, okay, looks like somebody just wasn't being careful when they wrote down the story.
Can I get back to that? Something we passed over before. There were stories of floods. There were flood stories predating Noach.
Yes.
How does that back up Noach's story if this is predating
They have like Near East, isn't like every like doesn't say as like every single like
yeah.
Near East, like
yeah. Gilgamesh is the most famous.
Has a version of a flood in there.
But
in what?
But as you say it, supposedly some of these Middle Eastern flood stories
predate
the story of Noah.
Right.
Yeah, but doesn't the scrolls predate the Torah scrolls? No. The actual event occurs at a different time in history.
I think that they say that the actual event would have occurred in a previous part of history, but they don't know that for sure. And there are answers that you can give.
So doesn't that lend credence to anybody who says this is just a copy of something else?
Dr. Walowalski, right, math professor in Flatbush, I added an article that he wrote for Tradition where he wanted to say, this is, you know, basically skirting the line of the way that Orthodox Jews interpret the Torah. He's from the school that says that basically the first 11 chapters of Bereishit didn't happen in a factual sense, that they're allegorical. He's from that school. And so he says the flood story is in there because it was a story that everybody knew. But you'll notice that the flood story of the Gilgamesh epic, for example, what's the point of the story? The point of the story is that the gods are kind of sick of men, you know, and so they want to get rid of them because they don't want man anymore. What's the point of the story of our flood story? Man is being bad and he wants to wash them away and start over again with good man. So it's a moral version, kind of the Gilgamesh epic, right? So that would be one way of dealing with it. There are, you know, other ways of dealing with it, but that would be one way of dealing with it.
Yeah, exactly. The story is at the beginning of the Torah, so...
This is one way of dealing with it. I personally don't connect to that so much, but it's certainly,
it definitely makes sense to me.
I think Rabbi Sachs writes like this as well, or at least he opens it up as a possibility.
We don't have to believe, I mean, there's no, the way that the creation happened and all the stories at the beginning have to have happened. I mean,
it's an option. It's an option that they're allegorical. It's an option.
Detract from it that it didn't happen.
No, I don't think it would detract from it. So that's Rabbi Tau. Rabbi Tau basically just says don't talk about it. There's obvious problems with that. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman was one of the rabbis who dealt with this right at the beginning. He lived from 1843 to 1921. He was a huge posek, Melamed Lahoil, from Germany, and he was debating. He was in the academic world, so he was debating with the proponents of these kinds of theories. He calling me from England. Somebody's calling me from the United Kingdom. I guess I can.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Probably good reception in here. So he couldn't hear me, but I could hear him. I don't know who it was. Someone with a British accent. Is this still going? Okay. So Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, and I really wanted to start with this, he writes in his introduction, says, I willingly agree that in consequence of the foundation of my belief, I am unable to arrive at the conclusion that the Pentateuch was written by anyone other than Moses. Right? So he's honest. We believe that the whole Bible is true, holy, and of divine origin, that every word of the Torah was inscribed by divine command. We must not presume to set ourselves up as critics of the author of a biblical text. The Jewish commentator must constantly be on guard against interpreting the passage in such a way as to appear to be in conflict with traditional halacha. Just as the Torah is a divine revelation, must not contradict itself, in the same way it must not contradict the oral law, which is of divine origin. Right. So basically he says, look, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. You know what I'm going to say before I even say anything, but I'm going to jump into the fray anyways. And he dealt with all the biblical, but really more from the halachic aspect. In other words, he wasn't so interested in debating about the way that the stories are written. He was much more interested in debating, for example, how many times does the Torah mention that you're not allowed to cook a kid in its mother's milk? Three times. It's a little bit overkill, no? And each time in a different context, and it's the same thing each time. And then what does the halacha do with it? It says one refers to cooking, one refers to eating, and one refers to getting benefit from it. You would expect that if that's what the Torah wanted you to do, it would have just written that. And also, why does it have to write it three times from a pshat level? What?
It leaves it open. It's vague.
Right. Right. And so he's, so the biblical critics look at that and they say, boom, three authors.
Genius.
Three authors. That's the answer.
So the author is in a stupid editor.
Yeah. Now, there, he has a long piece trying to explain what the basis of the Torah Shebaal Peh's interpretation and weaving it in to exactly why it's mentioned, where it's mentioned each time, and how the rabbi saw that each one adds something in the halakha. That's what he spends time doing. I actually don't have it on me right now. And it was definitely, it was complicated. And, you know, if you're not really into this kind of debating, it won't do much for you. I can tell you that. But that was his approach. His approach is basically taking them head on. And every time they bring up something new, something that you can't easily find in Chazal an answer for, he would work hard. And he'd say, we need to answer their questions. In other words, he said, absolutely we should listen to the biblical critics. And we should answer all their questions. Because by answering all their questions, we'll get a better understanding of Torah. That was his approach. He wasn't interested in the story so much, but in terms of the halakha, that's what he would do. That was one school of thought. Another school of thought was Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, Zatzal, from the Israeli rabbi from the, well, he wasn't originally from Israel, originally from Germany also, I think, but he was a huge academic here in, they hold of him in the Gush, and I think he was Hebrew University, I think that's where he did, and he was one of the main people on the Keter studying that, that text of the Torah. And he had a totally different position. He said we absolutely should recognize the points that the Bible critics make, because and we should even notice that they are correct in noting that there are different voices in the Bible. In other words, the biblical critics say there's J, P, E, and D, and they're right. There is J, P, E, and D. It's just that J, P, E, and D all happen to be God. And so if you notice that in one place of the book, this style is used, or this name is used, or it contradicts this other story, that's because God writes in a way which reflects different aspects of himself.
I thought it was Moshe that wrote it.
He did, but he dictated to Moshe. God is the ultimate author. Every word was dictated to Moshe.
Every word was
dictated to Moshe.
The seven last.
Every pasuk for the first four books. The fifth book of Dvarim is somewhat vague, because some understand that Moshe basically wrote it and then God ratified it. But even there, God agreed to every word.
If there's different styles, it definitely seems to lend itself more to the sense that it was written over a period of time.
So have you read a modern novel lately? It's an interesting trend. My wife noticed it in the girl books that she's reading. I noticed it in the science fiction and fantasy books that I've been reading. I'll give you an example. It's Trafe, but I'll give you the example anyways. Game of Thrones, before it was a show, it was a book, right? So I read the first three books that came out when I was in high school, and I was enthralled, because it was actually the first time that I saw the author do, to the degree that he did, George R. R. Martin. Every chapter is a different author, is a different character, and each character has his own way of thinking, his own accent, his own background, and each chapter was totally different from every other chapter. And if you didn't know, you would say each chapter was written by a different author. But they weren't. They were all written by this really large guy who's probably going to die before he finished writing the books. And he captured that perfectly. Why would it be strange for God to be able to do exactly the same thing?
It just makes more sense.
Which one?
That if it was Moshe that wrote the Torah,
yeah,
and he was divinely inspired by God,
right?
Then, and it was written over a period of time, he had different, maybe had different outlooks or different understandings of the divine inspirations that he was getting throughout those years, and it just meant that it was written in a different style because it was written over a period of time.
You're suggesting that Moshe changed the way?
No.
So this is not.
I'm not saying Moshe changed anything.
But what about Bereshit and Shemot, right? So we're saying the same thing is true of Bereshit. You just take just the book of Bereshit, and you can find different streams, different voices, different styles, just in Bereshit, right? The question becomes why. So one answer would be because J wanted to emphasize Yehuda and how he was great, And E wanted to say how Yehuda was terrible, so he put in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which has its own style. And this one wanted to emphasize how great Yosef was, so he put in this story about Yosef, how he was wronged. And this one wanted to show how Yosef was terrible, so he put in the story about Potiphar, something like that. So, no. If you find different styles, if you find different modes, it's because God is so good at writing that he can do that. Now, question becomes then only a matter of interpretation. Why does he do it? So that's what Rabbi Breuer wrote his book about. He wrote about why this voice is used here and this voice is used there. Why does Hashem's name show up here as Yudke Vavke and shows up there as Elohim? And he drew on, obviously, the Kabbalistic notions of Yudke Vavke being a personal name and Elohim being a name that refers to Teva. You can't open up almost any Rishon or Achron without seeing these kinds of ideas. And it was just, they're basically taken for granted. And the biblical critics basically say that, no, this means that it's different authors. And we say, no, it's just different strands of divine wisdom, which is implanted in different ways each time.
Which the rabbis were adamant that every single letter was dictated by God.
Right.
Adamant.
Yes. Says that Hashem said a pasuk, Moshe said it back, and then Moshe wrote it down. As I said, the only explanation is Devarim, which there is a great deal of debate about whether Moshe basically wrote down his own musings and then God ratified it, or it was basically the same as everything else. The big debate amongst the Ramban has his own shita about it. By the way, you remember a long time ago we read the Ramban, his Akdama to Bereishis. And there was a line there, which I meant to hark back to. Remember over there, he notes that, you know, isn't it strange that most of, you know, 4/5 of the Torah, it says, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. But in Bereishis, you don't find that. Why doesn't Bereishis open up with Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor? Right. She said, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor, Bereishit bar Elokim et Hashemayim et Haaretz.
It would have made it easier.
Right, so Ramban says, it's such an insightful question, right? You wouldn't expect that kind of question, right? That's a question he came up with 1,000 years ago. It's a very modern type of question. And he says, because Moshe is not the main character of the Torah, God is. So when Moshe is writing the Torah dictated to him by God, so he's not going to start with Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor over there, because that's not, that the Torah is its own story. It's not only the story of Moshe, it's not only the story of the writing of the Torah, it's the story of Jewish history.
We don't need it anyway, because there are certain parts of the Torah which could only have come if Hashem had told Moshe. So the historical parts you can bring through, but you know, Parshat Shlach is one that's always brought as, yeah, there has to have been from Hashem, because there's right. no other witnesses. The whole story about what was happening with, you know, going to another mountain and another mountain. There were no Jewish witnesses there. There was no one around.
Okay.
There was a dialogue purely between Hashem and Moshe.
Balak, you could also give Parshas Balak is the easiest. We noticed that the Gemara said that.
There,
right.
Balak totally is just Hashem. It's totally dictated by Hashem.
Right.
It was an independent activity, a dialogue that was going on.
No, listen. You're coming from the standpoint you're assuming it's true. Biblical criticism is saying, is like, I have this text. I have to verify every single word of it. It could just be that some bloke just made it up. Like, he made up the musings that someone, you know, like.
Right. If it's a story, then it's a story. So it doesn't really matter how they knew it, because it was made up. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, but biblical criticism must also go into the fact that the Torah isn't written chronologically. So it jumps around.
Right.
A lot of.
Right.
Bar-midbar, the first,
yeah, they love that.
They aren't in the correct order.
Right. So those are kinds of the underpinnings of biblical criticism. It notes that there's contradictions. It notes that there are different styles, different names. It notes that there are things in the Torah that seem to antedate the Torah. They come after the Torah coming out. So how could they be in there? They note that the styles sometimes come from time periods which they say come after the writing of the Torah. Our defense would be that we can answer all of their questions, number one. So if we can answer all of their questions, then there's not really any reason to doubt it. then you combine that with, we have a tradition, and they have never really sufficiently explained how or why anybody would have been fooled by the redactor. Right? As Rabbi Karmi said, and we said at the beginning, for 2,500 years, everybody thought that it was written by one author, and then in 1700, somebody discovered all of a sudden that there were all these obvious, glaring mistakes that mean that it wasn't. Right? The only way that this could work is if the redactor had done such a good job that nobody could figure it out. But that's clearly not what happened.
So that people forgot.
And that people forgot.
Well, there should have been a tradition. There had to have been a large enough time for people to be convinced that this was an original book, that everything happened was true, and everyone forget that there was a process, that there was a period of time when people didn't believe it.
Well, they did believe, or they always knew that it was written by multiple people.
But we don't find any trace of that ever. We don't find... That's the amazing thing. You don't find anyone ever suggesting that, okay, there are... This one book comes from four different books. Four different traditions.
Gomorrah and Mishnah to fit there.
Look, we have a clear path back at least to Ezra, right? You really don't have trouble getting back to Ezra.
But like the Gomorrah was edited by the Cohen, right?
Right.
So maybe some.
But we have old Gemaras.
How?
I don't know.
We have a predate the Goanish times.
I don't know.
It's quite a stretch.
Well, there's 1,000 years between Moshe and Ezra.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. But so we have to explain. You have to explain.
The final versions we have would have come out around.
Right. They say that it was written 800 and 600 and 500, but you don't have any trace in any of those time periods of the distinct strands. Right. You don't have. Any other version.
There should have been tradition.
We found scrolls in the Qumran caves that have versions of the Torah, and there's nothing, no glaring differences in terms of stories or anything like that. So that's kind of as Rabbi Hoffman said, I know where I'm going to come out even before I start, but it's still interesting to talk about because. I am of the school that says that there is what to learn. The questions that they bring up are really, really great questions. And sometimes they really edify how we learn the Torah.
The key thing all people prove is that they come from the assumption it's just a book.
Yeah.
And therefore, and there's obviously no such thing as divine. So we just have to explain the book in front of us.
Right.
Which is why they have to weave these creative stories. And they're forced to answer these questions because there is no Haimiyah.
I don't know if that's totally fair. They could just say we don't believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh, and then we notice that there are all these problems, so we have to come up with an explanation.
Whatever they want, to explain the text. It's no different from studying Shakespeare.
Right. Although you do have some believers who accept some of the claims of the biblical critics and say that no, things were changed. In other words, that's a plausible belief. It's not one that I necessarily subscribe to. That no, indeed, lifnei melech melech melechei Yisrael. That was added in afterwards. Say it.
So you can have an argument about someone who's only acknowledging half of your.
They're not interested in tradition. They have a book in front of them. They want to explain.
You're not interested, but they don't argue with me. But they don't argue with me about something that is a core part of it. Like, this is who I am, and this is what we are. Are you going to accept half of it, and then you want to debate with me about it?
They're not accepting half of it. They're accepting none of it. This is just a book.
Fine. No, but they are accepting half of it, because they're saying the only thing that exists on some level is Torah Shebaal Peh. But we don't have a common baseline which to have any dialogue. Because to me, I'm not separating out the two. I can't separate the two. They are one. They are one entity. And if you're going to say, I accept part of it, now let's just debate part of it. Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I can't talk to you about tefillin or anything. Not just the historical order of it and who wrote it.
But they're going to say back to you that you're not listening to me either. Because obviously, if Torah Shebaal Peh is right, then that's begging the question. Then everything is explained. But we don't think that Tarshabal Peh is right. And we have an alternative explanation for how this book got to us in front of us. And that's it.
In which case, we're on different playing fields.
So you're kind of taking the Rabbi Tao approach, which is, you know, it's not worth talking about any of this because you're not accepting my premises, so the whole thing is off.
Yeah, but there's issues with the Torah Shabbat. There's no one version of what we believe the Torah Shabbat goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah Shabbat is littered with difference of opinion.
Correct.
Or just a difference of opinion or a difference of tradition that came along. So there's no one tradition that necessarily dictates exactly what's in the Torah. There's a difference of opinion.
Typically, when it's a debate about tradition, you do find agreement. In other words, the moment somebody says, I have a tradition like this, it's usually the end of the debate. The difference has come up when they're arguing about utilization of midrashic principles. This one says, I think this is a kal vachomer that works this way, and the other one says, well, I have a gzeira shava that works like this. That's when you have differences. When one of them gets up and says, well, I have a tradition from my father, from his father, from his father, from Moshe Rabbeinu, the other guy just goes away.
Okay, there's a difference of understanding, interpretation.
Because those understandings come after. That's part of Torah Shebaal Peh, but only in the sense that...
The Ramban, this one, they all have different interpretations of even what the Torah Shebaal Peh says.
Right.
What it means.
Right.
So there's no one interpretation of the Torah. It's lots of people's different interpretations of what the Torah is.
That's true.
So there's...
But there are some things that everyone agrees.
So there's no one set of we just happen to be living the Judaism we're living today. There's no one to say that this is the way to be. There's no one truth in terms of how we should be living Judaism. There's a framework that allows us to come to reach the Judaism that we're practicing today.
It could have looked differently.
It could have looked differently.
In certain ways. In other ways it couldn't have looked differently.
Possibly.
But in certain ways, it could have looked differently if historically things had worked out different ways. And there are some who say that God makes sure that it looks this way. Okay. But Poseidon, that's a theory. In other words, we could be living in a Beit Shammai world, right? Which would look very different in terms of the way halacha is practiced. That was a viable world, and we don't. Why don't we? Either because of chance or because that's the way that God wanted it.
But it's a framework the rabbis and the tradition are put in place, how to make decisions, because there have been lots of different traditions around. It was a framework that was put in place, how to make decisions.
Right.
But I think that isn't the main thing just an understanding that the Torah is divinely inspired.
Yes.
As long as we have that as our basis, then everything that comes after is just, as I said, a framework that we're living in. There's no way to know that it's the true way of living just happens to be the way that our tradition has dictated that we live today.
But we can't be lazy. We can't be lazy and just throw up our hands and say, you know what, everything's fine. You have to put in the work. And when you put in the work, so then you start to come to closer to truth. Now, in the end of the day, it may be that you get to a certain point where you say, okay, I understand the truth is. The truth is it could be either this way or that way. That's the truth.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes you get to a point like that. You say the truth is either this way or that way. But you got to put in the work to get to there. You can't just say, it looks like there's plenty of truth, so I'll just pick whatever I want. You can't do that.
No, of course. Because Judaism is a framework with which we live in. It's got to be, everyone's going to be doing, the majority of them doing the same thing. Obviously, you have different traditions between even the people today.
Would it be too far to say that those who ascribe human authorship of the Torah are atheists and they're looking for reasons to disprove religion bechlal? And therefore, the Torah isn't divine, the Quran isn't divine, the Hindu books aren't divine, everything is human, of human origin, and it's all atheistic, and that's how they justify their atheism.
I mean, I think most atheists don't feel like they need to justify their atheism. They think that they're right, and then they have this book called the Bible, and they want to explain how the Bible came to be.
Right.
And you have plenty of people...
Their explanation of the Bible is their rationale for their atheism.
It's obviously going to be lacking divine authorship. That's obviously at the basis of the documentary hypothesis, is that this was put together... Although, I mean, that's not totally true. Meaning, again, they could come up with a model where, let's say, Jay had a certain version of the way that things worked out and the way that God gave the Torah to Moses, and E had a different version of that, and it actually happened, but they came together. But most wouldn't say like that.
I don't think. Some mix of that.
Conservative definitely believes in something like that because they believe that halakha evolves and changes over time. And actually, there are conservatives who say, oh, if you find the difference between what it says in Shemot and what it says in Devarim, that's because over time, Moshe kind of changed his view of how, or even God, changed his view of how halakha should work. That exists.
You see, you have three religious...
So those are the three main orthodox approaches. I guess the fourth approach would be the Weissa Livni and the Tamar Rosh, which is kind of a blend, which is to say, we said this before, which is to say, we believe in the divine authorship of a Torah, but kind of what David is saying, that things may have changed along the line, and that's because God gave the Torah to us, and we messed things up. Now, we believe in some version of that, because we already know that it's not letter perfect, right? But we do believe that for the most part, all the stories and the major sentences in the Torah are all the same as they were 3,000 years ago. That's what I believe. But for example, like we said before, you can find people who say that things like the Lifnei Moloch Malchei Yisrael, or when it says Vaknani Az Ba'aretz and things like that they were interpolated afterwards, or that things were put in. So that's, you know, in other words, to concede the point to the biblical critics that there may have been post-Mosaic additions, but to still believe in general that the Torah is divinely given. That's, you know, an approach. It's not something that, you know, you would teach in Panovich, but, or in Gush even, for that matter, I think. To believe that the Torah was given by God, and for the most part, I don't know what percentage, 95% of the Torah is exactly what Hashem gave to Moshe. But there were things that were added in later by, over time, by whom? Who knows?
But also divinely written.
As in our current...
Who knows? Yes, you know? No, maybe.
But we said in the previous...
What's your like percentages? Sorry.
Yeah, you're right. It's a slippery slope. But when you have psukim that are hard to explain... And the most logical explanation is that they were written by somebody after Moses closed the Torah. You know, like we have the second edition, right? Second edition, we have changes. Fine, Seder. That's what they believe.
In line with what we've been saying until now, we've said until now that they were definitively agree, or the Gemara, whatever, agrees that there were different versions of the Torah. Okay, minor ones.
Those are supposedly mistakes. And there were letter differences, not sentence differences.
Not word differences, but it was an accepted understanding that there were differences between them. So it's not that difficult to then think that, okay, if there were letter differences, then it's 1,000 years.
Over 3,000 years or 2,000 versus the last. It's quite possible that things got added in.
There's a concept called Diktukei Sofrim, or Tikkunei Sofrim, which different people have. Which shows up in Shas, and different people have interpreted it in different ways. One of the ways is to say that there were things that were put in by the Sofrim, with the best of intentions, to change the text of the Torah to make it more acceptable. I'll give you one example. When Avram sees the three men coming towards his tent, right? So he says to somebody, "Sit here while I go and deal with this," right? Who does he say that to? So Rashi has two opinions about this. One opinion says that he says it to God, "Sit here while I go," and the other opinion says that he says it to the angels, "Wait over there while I finish with God," right? Now one of those sounds more acceptable than the other. The second one sounds more acceptable, he's not going to tell Hashem to wait here while he's going to do something, right? But according to, it's vague in the text. So some say, it was Dikutukei Sofrim. The original version is clear that he actually said it to God. That was unacceptable. So it was changed to be more vague, so he could have been saying it to, that's one version of what that means. It's from, it's made the Torah more from, right? It's a from Tikkunei Sofrim, okay? That's like, it floats around. The concept of Dikutukei Sofrim comes out. I can't remember. I remember learning it, in Intro to Bible. I can't remember.
Intro to Bible.
Oh, it was the best course I ever took in my life. The best course I ever took in my life.
It makes so much more sense that we can understand it. We can try and believe that the Torah was given divinely by God. But over a thousand-year period.
But it's discrepancies in different places.
We're saying over a thousand-year period. Where it was just people writing them, and we talked about the fact that the Torah were missing and they found
them. The Taimonim who split in Bayit Rishon, and they have
Bayit Rishon. No, not Bayit Rishon.
Bayit Rishon they split.
They had communications backwards and forth.
They only have one or two letter differences. They have big differences between that. The Taimonides,
Ezra
was the one that. Well, we said in the previous that when we spoke last time that maybe there was a period of time when
we had a pshat really though that said that no, that they always had a Sefer Torah, which is different between Ivrit and Asherit.
Right, exactly.
Remember?
We said potentially for the thought that said that Ezra was the one that wrote it in Asherit.
And he corrected things. You're right. There were things that he had to correct.
Right, but over that period of time, if we say that Ezra potentially is the beginning of the Bible that we have, Torah that we have today.
But for example, even there, right? How did Ezra correct it? Gemara in the Yerushalmi has this. It says that he used those three Sifrei Torah. Remember the three Sifrei Torah in the Ezra, right? So some ascribe that to actually. Some say that it was later for everybody, or some say that this is how Ezra did it. In other words, he had three Sifrei Torah. And whenever he had a question, he would consult and go with two out of the three, which meant that it was always the case that two out of the three were corresponded with each other. That none of the three were actually correct, but they were close enough that he could always rely on finding some kind of consistency between those two three. And the only thing he found were literal differences, pretty much. But you're not going to that. I don't know if
it could be like sentences.
No, you're not going to find sentences. You're not going to find, you know, that would be weird that you would find a sentence missing or an extra sentence. That would be weird, I think.
It would be pretty logical.
It's possible. It's possible.
Over a thousand period. Thousand
it's possible. It's not what I believe, but it's a viable theory. And it,
isn't Apikorsos to believe
that? I don't know. I mean, some people would say that it's Apikorsos. Rav Moshe, put in Cherem and ordered them to stop printing Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's parish to the Torah, a huge Rishon, because he had statements like this in the parish, right? The Ibn Ezra has statements like that in the parish, and people get really upset about it. Or actually, he hides them, supposedly. The Ibn Ezra writes things like, I have a big secret about this, but I don't want to tell anybody what it is. So there he's actually okay with it. But there are other places where he says, like, by Azza, Achnani Azbarat.
It's also because of the, from editing that's happened today, because of the worries about that, not necessarily that it may not be a valid point, it's more just a matter of having to hide it.
Right, Rav Moshe found it unacceptable that Rav Yehuda Chassid would have said that there was something. Rav Moshe couldn't deal with it, yeah. Right. But he, you know, if you believe that he really wrote it, so then apparently at some point in time that was an acceptable thing to say, you know, and it's not surprising because, you know, when did it become unacceptable to say things like that? I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing. No, I'm guessing around the time when the Rambam wrote it, when the Rambam wrote his eighth Ikar and said the Torah that we have in our hands was dictated by God to Moses and every single word, and Moses didn't make anything up. And we've talked about there are different interpretations about that. But I'm guessing that around that time, it became an ironclad rule of Orthodox Judaism that you cannot believe anything other than that the Torah was written by God. And that's obvious. But that what we have now is the same. What happened before the Rambam? I honestly don't know. Meaning, you don't find statements as vociferous as what the Rambam writes.
It's so illogical.
It's not illogical at all. It's not illogical. It's not illogical.
To believe that the people were literally, there's no computers who were doing it either from copies.
We know they had mistakes. No, even the Rambam must have acknowledged that there were mistakes. He knew that there were mistakes.
So his statement was not ironclad.
It couldn't have been. It couldn't have been that the Rambam believed that the Torah that he had in front of him was exactly the same as what Moshe. It couldn't be. It's impossible to believe that Moshe, that the Rambam really believed that. What did he believe? So there are different versions of that, but definitely it carries the weight.
I mean, there's a huge problem if we don't believe that what we have in front of us is what God gave us.
Huge problem.
That's a huge problem. But
It's the basis of modern nonsense.
Yeah, but to believe that humans didn't make a mistake over thousands of years before...
They did make mistakes.
They did make mistakes. And if they did make mistakes, then how can we believe that it was only single letters? It doesn't...
Well, because that's all we find. I mean, the fact is, that's what we find. We find only single letters. For as far back as we can go, that's all we find. And given the fact that... And that's all you would expect to find. In other words, look, if you go back, I don't know when Hemingway wrote Moby Dick or whatever, you're not going to expect
Melville wrote Moby Dick.
Melville, sorry, there you go. But you would expect to find that if you looked at 50 different versions of Moby Dick, you would find a lot of differences. You would not expect to find an extra sentence or a different ending. Unless somebody was being sneaky, right? You would expect to find typos. You would not expect to find another chapter. And you wouldn't. And you wouldn't find that, right? In almost any book, you look up Shakespeare, you're not going to find an extra line, I think. And Shakespeare doesn't carry the weight and the importance of the Torah. So that's it. But if there really were different versions, then you would expect to find that. That's the problem. Getting back to the documentary hypothesis, which is only one version of biblical criticism, right? You would expect to find those differences somewhere, I think.
Not necessarily. The point is, if you say Ezra took three Sefer Torah and they just happen to be virtually the same, and you don't know what happened before he took it, somebody could have added in a line somewhere along the a sentence somewhere along the line,
right,
in history, and therefore it got into these three Sifrei Torah that Ezra put together.
Right, it's possible, but given that there were so many Sifrei Torah, you know, floating around, it's almost like this blockchain, no? Like,
self-validation.
I don't know. There's some kind of self-validation there.
There's always going to be people like, you know, about Per, and there's always like, it's just...
You'd have to assume some kind of conspiracy. You'd have to assume a conspiracy, which... No, I don't know what the reason for it would be.
Basically, because people went out all over the world, and you're going to have a Sifrei Torah...
Yeah, you don't.
...all over different places of the world, and then you'd see a difference... Yeah. And there isn't those differences.
No, there
isn't. You just got letter differences.
But we don't have any Sifrei Torah more than 1,000 years old.
No, but back then...
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, you have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which have fragments.
But they're fragments.
They're fragments, and there's all kinds of stuff in there. But in terms of the Old Testament stuff, there's no differences. You have extra books in there. That's a whole other topic.
I mean, our Old Testament, the five books of Moses is the same as the Old Testament.
Yeah.
So... whatever that picked up, so that's probably the...
Saying there's stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Qumran caves, which is, they have more than what's in our canon, and there's reasons for that.
It's almost like the religion becomes more of a belief in ourselves rather than God.
I hear that.
Because we're almost like ascribing our... God didn't re-give the Torah. He gave it once, and we were the ones that transmitted it down. So we've got to have a lot of faith
in tradition.
In tradition,
yeah.
To believe. So that's basically.
Well, if you believe in God, you can also believe.
It's not belief in God.
Which he told us to do, right? He told us to.
We
got it to the bincha. Lotosu mikol asher yigidu lecha yaminu
smal. That doesn't make sense. That's why we believe so strongly in tradition. It's not.
Yeah.
Okay, we believe in God with the beginning, but the what keeps Judaism together. Is maybe the tradition.
And it's necessary. And
the whole starting point of Yom Yisroel. Why is that such a fundamental thing? Because the theory being that, you know, 3 million people didn't just make it up one day and then be able to pass over exactly the same story to all of their generations afterwards.
And we have all these mitzvot that repeated over and over. We talked about that from the Ramban.
I said to my kids, and I guess I'm coming from a platform, you know, after the Ramban, grew up with that, you know, you just never questioned, didn't have those kind of things. But I said to my kids, try and get any of your kids in your class to walk out and tell the same story, just amongst the 30 of you. You'll each go home and tell your parents, and you couldn't do it. And then multiply that by a factor to be able to get 600,000 people, you're counting, 3 million who were there, to all have more or less the same story,
That's the old telephone game.
Exactly. That's what we said in the beginning.
But I mean, there still is a thousand. There's a thousand years of
belief in God and belief in the Masorah being able to be transmitted in the same way.
Yeah, but that, exactly. That's what belief.
It's not the Masorah is not the God element. The Masorah is that I trust that this has been propagated.
Exactly.
It's
no longer
But David, that's where the Ramban comes in, where he says he set up the mitzvot to repeat the story over and over.
You know, my mom knows all the Mishnayot because she's.
That's why he did this. So in other words, at least from the other side, we can understand how it could have happened, that we still have the story. Because every single generation has 30% of the 613 mitzvot that they do maintain and amplify that story over and over and over. So we've had the tefillin for 3,000 years. And they tell the same story over and over, and there's a reason for that. We've been doing Pesach for 3,000 years, every year.
So we know that's the thing. It's not about God anymore. It's about the passage of the stories through the generations.
Yeah, I mean, we also hopefully have experiences with God Himself.
Experience with God, but God has not. There's not been another revelation since the revelation of Mount Sinai.
That's our story. Yeah, we live in a world of. Somebody was saying after a Megillas Esther, right? The most basic line of the whole story is Umi Yodea. And the first two words, Umi Yodea. We don't know. We don't know why we're here. We don't know what we're supposed to be doing. We just we're trying to figure it out. Okay. Shkuyach. I wanted to bring more examples of the kinds of issues that they bring up.
You're just stuffing up our religion, or
but I didn't really have time to write them down. I've been a little busy.